glowing red and hot to the touch. Yet she stood in the dark, shivering. An electronic jangle announced a text message from Edward asking where she was. Please let me be wrong about this. Time to join the party.
There you are, love.
Edward beckoned her over to a cluster of guests.
Let me introduce you to the missus,
he said to them. A series of names and extended hands followed, which she shook. But she made no effort to remember the names. She'd forget them all in a matter of hours anyway.
How do you like them?
Edward motioned to the Christmas lights. It was more theft than homage, but she lied and praised the decorations.
Do try the Scotch eggs,
Edward urged.
It's a new recipe, and if they go over well tonight, I may add them to the menu.
As she stood around making polite chit-chat, it was as if a fog rolled in, surrounding her, dimming the voices around her, reducing her to smiles and nods. More guests arrived, and Edward went off to greet them. This was her chance. She excused herself and checked her phone for the time. 10:05 p.m. When she was sure nobody was looking, Una stepped away. Upstairs, she unlocked Edward's office and with one final backward glance, slipped inside. She set her phone down and sat at his desk. Her hands hovered over it like a piano player poised to start a challenging piece. Why direct so much effort to discover her marriage was a lie? She could let it be and spare herself this pain. After all, once the clock struck midnight, this Una would leap again, while 2004 Una would remain clueless about the preceding months. What would the truth solve anyway? Nothing. The truth would be its own reward, or punishment. It was New Year's Eve, and if she didn't learn the truth about her marriage to Edward today, she'd never know if he'd deceived her. She had to know. Una unlocked the bottom desk drawer and took out the computer. Before she flipped it open, an idea tugged at the back of her mind like an impatient child. What else is in here? What's important enough to be locked away? The laptop had been on a stack of t-shirts bearing beverage logos, and the drawer also contained hanging file folders brimming with invoices and contracts. Except the last one, which held something different. A handful of Polaroid pictures. Francesca naked in each one. Except for the last one, which featured her with a shirtless Edward. An oily disgust simmered inside Una. But there was also a lightness, like her head might float away from the rest of her body. Relief? She hadn't been reading into things. She wasn't paranoid. A certain satisfaction comes with being right, even when it's something you'd rather be wrong about. Is there more? Sifting through the t-shirts, beneath them she found a rectangular jewelry box. Too short for a necklace. This one was sized for a bracelet. She opened the box. Inside was a silver watch, its face dotted with black stars. Its hands stopped at 3 o'clock. Una gasped and held her breath. It couldn't be. Her watch. She clutched it in one hand, covered her mouth with the other, and ran into the adjoining bathroom. Nothing came out but heaving sobs as she bent over the sink, inhaling a sharp odor of pine-scented bleach. Any satisfaction at being vindicated was gone. Her legs began to give way, but she fought gravity and remained standing, even as the white tile floor beckoned. She wanted to sleep for days, sleep into the next year, sleep through several years. If only she could curl up on the floor right now. I'm sorry, Mom. I wish I'd listened. I wish you could help me now. How badly Una wanted to cry and cry and be wrapped in her mother's comforting arms. Madeline would have surely set aside her own wounded feelings to soothe her daughter. She wouldn't be smug or petty or say she'd known Edward was rotten all along. Except Madeline was off with her own rotten Romeo, on a cruise and unreachable. And Una had less than 2 hours to confront her husband and write herself a new letter.
Una?
Beside the desk was Edward. His eyes darted to the ransacked drawer, the scattered photos, and landed on her.
Look, whatever you think this— Stop!
The word boomed out of her mouth, startling them both.
I know what this is. I saw Francesca playing footsie with you the other night. I just wanted proof before you found a way to make me think I was a paranoid, jealous wife. So I went through your things.
Something a paranoid, jealous wife would never do, of course.
His eyebrows knit together with amusement.
And you found proof in some photos taken years ago.
The blasé reaction made Una stand up straighter, imagining her vertebrae were infused with steel.
Don't you fucking dare. I know you're a two-timing douche lord, but we'll get back to that. First, how the hell did you end up with my watch?
She held up the timepiece. Rapid blinks, confusion flickering across his features.
I didn't.
I know it's the one Dale gave me, so spare me the bullshit.
Edward raked his fingers through his hair.
Let's sit down and talk this over rationally.
You can sit, but I'm good standing.
Her sharp tone made him falter, but he also remained standing. They faced each other from across the desk.
It is my watch, right?
Una, I owe you an enormous apology. Yes, it's your watch.
How did you get it?
You know how I play poker with the lads,
he began.
One of my mates started inviting me to high-stakes poker games.
Edward gnawed on his lower lip as he stared at his shoes.
I played well for a while, and I cocked it up. Ended up owing scads of money.
Why didn't you come to me?
Mouth pursed into a tight knot.
And tell you the man you're about to marry is a loser who's 200 grand in the hole.
Better than a loser who robs me of my prized possessions.
There was a tickle in Una's throat, a sourness in her mouth.
So you set up that burglary?
A sheepish grimace as he scratched the back of his neck.
It was a low thing to do. I'm so sorry. They weren't supposed to take the watch.
But you got it back for me.
Una glanced down at its silver face.
How sweet,
spoken with venom.
I just couldn't find the right moment, the right way to give it to you.
And now I won't be able to wear it again, because it'll make me think of what you've done. You've ruined something so special to me. While we're returning things, you can have these.
She pulled her engagement and wedding rings off and dropped them on the desk.
So how long have you been fucking Francesca?
The vile question caused a whiplash shiver to snake through her body. Edward wore an expression ready for denial, but the hard look in her eyes made him change course.
3 years, on and off. But we stopped after I met you.
Bullshit.
All right, there was one slip after a late night working. One. But that was it. She keeps making advances toward me, and I try to reject them. I've wanted to end things with her for a while now. Well, she's good at her job, and she's my best chance for making Clary's a success.
She's your best chance.
Her expertise, and you, of course you,
he sputtered.
Well, thanks for using both of us to make your precious restaurant dream come true.
Her snide tone made him wince.
I'm not using you. You might not believe this, but I truly am in love with you.
Una laughed even as hot tears flooded her eyes.
Don't insult me by lying more. On top of the cheating and the stealing, it's a bit much.
I realize that, but Una, look at it this way. You know the worst, so there's no reason for me to lie. What I did was unforgivable, but I do have feelings for you. I've been utterly smitten with you since Egypt. You can't deny our chemistry is real. You can't force that kind of connection.
She had to bite down on her tongue to keep from agreeing out loud. But there was no room in her rage for sentimentality.
That was just sex.
It was never just sex. You know it was more than that.
His eyes grew wistful.
I'd do anything to earn your trust back.
It should have been the moment she boiled over with fury, roared at ear-piercing volumes. Yet she stood there, defeated, and managed only a whisper.
I thought this was something real.
It is, and still can be. Won't your brain reset or something at midnight?
In a way.
Well, What if you let yourself forget this? Use that blank slate for us to start over.
Are you out of your fucking mind? You want me to pretend you didn't betray me?
Una snorted.
By the way, where's that 2004 letter I wrote to myself? I want it back.
It's at the house. Listen, Una, we could still have a great life together. I'll cut Francesca out of my life for good. I swear it. I know I can make you happy.
Not gonna happen. For you to think I'd even consider it is crazy.
Crazier than losing your memory at the stroke of midnight every year.
She took in a long breath through her teeth.
I didn't say that to hurt you.
When Edward tried to come around to her side of the desk, she circled away from him.
I accept you for the way you are. I'm merely saying there's a lot about our relationship that's crazy. I married you knowing you'd forget me in January. I can handle that because I love you. And since we'd have this fresh start, you could...
I can't. I won't.
It was like her head was being injected with helium while the rest of her body turned to stone.
What time is it?
A bit after 11.
Shit!
She had to get home and tear up that letter. In case she didn't make it in time, she grabbed a blank server pad and pen off the desk to write a new one along the way. When Edward made to follow her, she gave him a deathly stare.
Don't come after me.
If you do, I'll burn this place to the ground before it even opens for business. How satisfying to see his face become a gruesome medley of fear, anguish, distress. Una ran downstairs. The party was in full tilt. Outcasts, hey ya, blasting over the stereo. The lyrics about shaking it like a Polaroid picture mocking her. She got her coat and pushed past guests to get to the front door. Two steps shy of the exit.
Have you seen Edward?
He's upstairs.
A wicked leer as she turned to Francesca.
And you're a pretentious cunt.
Not waiting for a reaction, Una bolted outside. One happy, perfect year was all she wanted. What a price to pay. I could have found Peter instead. I could have caught him at a better time. It was windy, but Una kept her coat open, let the bracing air wake her up, each gust whispering how gullible, how foolish. But she wouldn't be a victim. She'd eschew self-pity, harness responsibility, and take action. Reaching into her pocket for her phone.
Fuck!
It was still on Edward's desk. She wouldn't be able to call a cab or check the time, and she wouldn't make it home on foot before midnight. At least she had her Metro card. So this is how I end up on the F train.
Wait, let me guess, it gets delayed.
It did, arriving quickly but stalling short of the next stop due to a sick passenger. Near Una's seat was a rowdy group of drunk 20-something hipsters in skinny jeans and plaid scarves swaying, their complaints loud and slurred. The woman in the houndstooth coat was farther down the car reading a book. Facing the blank paper, she got as far as, "Dear Una," and paused. How to begin this new letter? Pent-up vitriol spilled onto the pages. She wrote with such vehemence the words left grooves in the paper. Once finished, she read the new letter and her frenzy waned. It was too intimidating, too acrimonious. She needed to warn 2004 Una, not scare the shit out of her. Una flipped to a blank page in the notepad and began again. Better to keep it to the headlines. Local time traveler to divorce scoundrel husband and pursue guitar teacher. The revised note was more direct, less upsetting. A satisfied nod and she clipped the pen to the pad. Just then, the stalled train pitched into motion and one of the drunk hipsters lost his balance. He stumbled into Una, knocking the pad and pen out of her hand. Ignoring his indifferent apology, Una jumped up to rescue the fallen notepad by the sliding doors, but his friends stood in her way.
Excuse me, I need to get...
A lurch as the train came to an abrupt stop. Before she could reach down, the doors opened and one of the hipsters shuffled forward, sweeping the notepad and pen into the gap between the train and platform.
Shit!
She cried out.
Next stop, 7th Avenue. Stand clear of the closing doors.
The group gave her a confused look as they stepped off the train. No air to breathe, like she'd been punched in the throat. A wheeze as she forced her lungs to obey. The rumble of the subway and the bitterness of bad luck shook free her tears. Una rushed to the woman in the houndstooth coat.
Please, I need a pen.
Her voice was pitched high with hysteria.
I need to warn myself to divorce Edward and find Peter. I know you have a pen. Hurry, I don't have much time.
The woman looked up from her book.
I'm sorry, I only heard half of what you said. You want to borrow a pen?
Yes, quickly, I...
Another lurch and Una was thrown off her feet. She didn't get a chance to finish her sentence. Part 6. On Some Faraway Beach. 1995. 31. 23. Chapter 23. Time was a rubber band pulling her back, back, back until snap. And panic flung her forward, bolted her upright with a startled cry like she'd been pushed off a high ledge.
Son of a bitch!
She burst into tears, covered her face. Guttural, primal noises came out of her, a bitterness that choked her. Betrayal like razor wire coiled around her, cut into her. Her sobs died down. She was in bed, but not her bed. And this wasn't her room, not her house. It wasn't even a house, more like a hut built by a castaway. Clawing aside a veil of mosquito netting, she stood and did a slow spin of her surroundings. A-line thatch ceiling, bamboo blinds, minimalist geometric furniture, its wood stained the color of melted chocolate mixed with blood. At one end of the room was a set of double doors. Una cracked them open and poked her head outside. There was a large patio, then a stretch of beach framed by palm tree silhouettes. The lapping tide, a subdued roar, the balmy air threaded with a fermented, fishy odor. And at one end of the balcony, on a wooden recliner, a sleeping figure. Una shrieked, and the figure bolted upright, matching her scream.
Mom?
Una?
Madeline rubbed her eyes, sat up straighter.
Darn it, did I sleep past midnight? I can't shake this jet lag.
Where the hell are we?
Come sit.
She patted the space beside her, beckoning her reluctant daughter. Residual anger pinballed within Una made her snippy.
Did we take a 3-hour tour and get stranded here? That's the only thing missing from my stupid fucking life.
We're in Phu Quoc, Vietnam. You said next year you'd be dealing with some shit and would be better off getting lost somewhere far away.
Ah, so she'd followed Kenzie's anger/grief management strategy. I'm surprised we're not in Thailand.
Is Kenzie here?
Who?
Then that would be a no.
What year is it?
It's 1995.
Which puts Kenzie probably in elementary school.
Of course, why would something ever work in my favor?
Una slapped her knees, dug her nails into them as fresh tears threatened. It only took her mother's hand on her back to release them.
I thought he was one of the good ones.
Una wept and wept, soaking Madeline's silk blouse.
I knew it wouldn't last, but I hoped.
The words were muffled against her mother's shoulder.
I thought I could change things, but it was all a lie.
Oh, honey, I'm so sorry. What happened?
I...
But more sobs choked her, and her face twisted with an anguish as she fought to catch her breath. All Madeline could do was stroke small circles on her daughter's back and murmur shushing sounds the way she did when Una had nightmares in the year following her father's death. After a minute, the cries ebbed into jerky breathing.
I need a tissue.
Let's go inside.
They settled on the sofa, Madeline armed with a glass of water and pack of tissues. Una blew her nose and wiped her damp cheeks.
I just don't get it. I couldn't prevent it when I leaped backward, but I could have the year before that. Yet there was no warning in the letter I read before I met him. Why wouldn't my earlier self try to stop me? Why had 2002 Una set her up like that?
I'm sure she... You had your reasons. Maybe you believed the good parts of the year outweighed the bad.
No, no.
Fervent head shaking.
Look at it this way. Whatever dreadful things happened, you won't have to live through them again.
Or at all. Because it's 1995. So it hasn't happened yet.
A thought like a firecracker set off in a dark room, bright and dangerous.
Maybe my earlier self wouldn't help me, but you could. If I tell you his name now, because I won't meet him until 2003.
The year dangled on her tongue, but she reeled it back in, uncertain.
You could warn me. Prevent the whole train wreck. If you knew his name, maybe.
A grim heaviness weighed down Madeline's features. This is one of your early leaps, isn't it? How old are you on the inside?
I just turned 23. If it's 1995,
Una flipped through a mental calendar.
I also just turned 31. Ugh, this will never stop feeling fucked up!
The end table beside her collected more balled up tissues.
How'd you know this was one of my early leaps?
Because a more mature you would never ask me to help you change your future.
Though I wish I could spare you this pain.
Lips trembling, she pressed them into a line, blinked hard, and asked,
"Was he violent?"
A vehement no, followed by a softer one. Fresh tears rolled down her face, and she wiped them away.
"He robbed me of. I just want to undo the whole thing."
Madeline put a hand on her daughter's arm in a gesture that said, "Slow down. Think this through."
"You know I'm here to help you any way that I can. But even if you tell me his name, I won't sabotage your relationship."
That made one of them. Had Una done the right thing sabotaging her mother's relationship? Even if Nathan was a certified creep and Madeline was funding his comfortable lifestyle, his presence brightened her life, brought a glimmer to her eyes that disappeared after being told it wouldn't last.
"Honey, please take some time with this."
Una unclenched her fists, like she'd just put down a loaded gun.
"You're right. I don't have to decide tonight."
She launched into a stream of grievances.
"God, I thought last year was gonna be awesome, but it ended up so shitty. Not only with him, I thought I'd finally begin my friendship with Kenzie. You don't even know Kenzie yet. But we had one tense, weird night, and then he took off. And you and me, we had the worst fight. It was awful. I never said sorry because I wasn't ready, and God, I was a chicken shit. I should have stepped up."
She clutched her chest. The pressure of thorny emotions festering within needed release.
"I'm so sorry. Even though you already forgave me, I didn't know what you were forgiving me for then. And now that I do, I can't tell you what I'm apologizing for. I'm just very sorry,"
Una cried. A flicker of fear swept away with a hurried smile.
"My darling, if future me forgives you, so does present day me."
She squeezed her daughter's shoulder.
"I can't fight with you like that again. You're the only constant in my life."
Una grabbed a cushion and held it over her stomach.
"And you were right about him, too. Don't you get tired of being right about everything?"
A single dejected chuckle.
"Of course I don't. And I've been wrong my fair share of times. I was wrong earlier tonight, thinking I could doze off and wake up before midnight. It must have been frightening for you to come to like that, somewhere new, alone."
"It's always a little scary and a little lonely."
"Well, I'll help make things less lonely."
Madeline stood and walked over to a mini fridge.
"How about some champagne? You can never feel truly sad if you're drinking champagne."
"I don't want any. I'm sorry."
The promise of a buzz was tempting, but it would lead to the bad kind of drunk, the dark, self-pitying kind. Her eyes roved the hut, landed on a windowsill lined with potted orchids.
"So we're in Vietnam, huh?"
"We've only been here a few days, but my goodness, it's stunning."
Could it be stunning enough to cool her volcanic fury? To say nothing of the queasy shame that she'd allowed herself to be suckered, so eager to love and be loved. She'd gotten it so wrong.
If she'd known the truth about Edward and warned herself in time, 2004 could have been a happier year. It could have been spent with Peter. The lost opportunity burned in her throat and instigated fresh tears. Madeline brought over 2 cans of soda and more tissues. I feel like I'm never gonna get it right. The tinny pop of the soda can was a punctuation mark on Una's self-pity. As much as I've tried to shape my life to have some coherence, every time I try to bond with someone, either I fail or they don't stay, or I can't stay because of leaping. I guess I should get used to the idea it'll usually be just me and you. Not every year. Madeline bared her teeth, preparing to say something unpleasant but necessary. Though some years, yes. It helps to look at it in the short term. Every year can be a tabula rasa, and once it's over, you can begin again. At square one. Not necessarily. That's how it feels. Una put down her soda and twisted her hands in her lap. Did I leave myself a letter? No. This time it's a present. Madeline handed her daughter a tiny crimson box. Una opened it and took out a platinum band made of 2 elongated wings. A small accompanying note in her handwriting read, "Anger can be an energy. Don't burn. Soar." Squinting, she checked the ring again. It had the same design as the one Kenzie wore in her last leap. Is there anything else? Any letter? That's it. Some years you find letters unnecessary, especially as you get used to leaping. Una put the ring on her left middle finger. There's no getting used to it. It's the worst. The powerlessness of it. She spat the words out, hot under her skin. How could she turn this anger into a fuel when all she wanted to do was incinerate her? At least I'm far away. Maybe the distance will help. Her words held little conviction. You sure you don't want to help change my future? Ask me again at the end of the year. The following morning brought a heat wave and unexpected optimism. Their hut was on a remote stretch of Vanilla Beach, the waters beyond an ombre of sapphire to blue topaz to palest jade. A rope swing hung from one leaning palm tree, a hammock strung between 2 others. It took effort to remain angry in such lovely surroundings. As the days passed and the temperature rose, the sun's fire served as a warped law of affinity. It quelled her internal inferno to a manageable flame. She still wanted to reveal Edward's name to Madeline, but she kept her mouth shut. They spent a week on the sleepy island, swimming, hiking the fringes of the dense jungle and virgin rainforests, eating fresh fruit and fish, singing along to songs Una strummed on her guitar while swaying in a hammock. Next, they flew to Hanoi. The city was hectic but small, its commotion palatable and easy to navigate. Their hotel was on the Hoan Kim Lake, a modest body of water that offered a modicum of tranquility amid the urban bustle. Roosters woke them at sunrise, and they began the day walking around the lake, sometimes joining the clusters of fellow early risers doing Tai Chi. They perused cramped shop stalls selling everything from fruit to flowers to party decorations. They visited the presidential palace and the monument containing Ho Chi Minh's preserved dead body. Every day, they bought gooey pudding made of mung bean paste from a woman mixing it in a large silver pot in the middle of the sidewalk, sitting on low plastic stools as they ate the sugary spoonfuls. They visited the Wah Lo prison, better known as the Hanoi Hilton, and balanced that somber outing by taking in a surprisingly elaborate puppet show. Distractions and delights abounded. But always, Edward Clary's name was balanced on the edge of Una's lips. She kept them sealed, but always her silence felt hard-won, a temporary thing. The culture shock was a tonic for Una. She found the machine gun staccato of the Vietnamese language and the surprising proliferation of Russian spoken oddly soothing. She embraced the unknowable and indecipherable. While Madeline grew nervous when they veered onto an unintended street, Una was happy to get lost down twisty paths with faded, tattered awnings bearing signs she couldn't read, signs she mentally rewrote to bear the name of her former husband. Sometimes Una felt like she'd traveled back even further in time. There were weathered natives in conical hats carrying yokes across their shoulders, balancing heavy straw baskets. There was a prevalence of bicycles and motorbikes over cars and buses, which they dodged daily at treacherous street crossings. There were the peeling facades of French colonial buildings, crammed together like stale geometric pastries. Una wanted to lean over their frilly balconies, smoke endless cigarettes, and pretend she was the sad heroine in an old movie. But instead, she walked on and sought out more of the unfamiliar to distract herself. Besides, she didn't smoke. When they had enough of the city, they took the train down to Halong Bay. "I think I'm ready to get on a boat again," Una said.
"Are you sure?"
her mother asked. "Not really. But I already missed the chance to cruise the Nile. And I don't want this stupid phobia to hold me back from seeing one of the coolest parts of this country. Those islands look hella gorgeous."
"Hella?"
"Very. Don't worry about it. Let's find us a boat." So they rented a junk for 3 days. If it capsized, if she drowned, so be it. On their way to the dock, Una thought of the incident in the meatpacking district 3 leaps ago, mouthing off to a cinder block of a stranger before her neck ended up in the noose of his fist. Part of her then wanted him to crush her. Part of her now wanted the boat to do the job instead. But a bigger part of her wanted to endure and survive, and was certain she would. The knowable future was her safety net. It bolstered her courage. This courage wavered on the dock. With great hesitation, she made it onto the boat. The first few hours aboard left her with aching fingers from gripping the railing so hard. But then she gave in to the soothing powers of the undulating horizon and the view, which was indeed hella gorgeous. The boat took them around hundreds of limestone islands poking out of the water like crooked, mossy teeth. At night, when the waves lapped against the boat and rocked Una to sleep, she whispered Edward's name into her pillow and hoped the next day it would hurt a little less. And it did. They took their time making their way through the rest of the country, down to sleepy Hue and picturesque Hoi An, where they rode motorcycles to the beach and had a new wardrobe of clothes made by expert tailors, which they shipped back to New York. They ate savory crepes with shrimp and pork, caramelized fish served in clay pots, salads with sliced banana flowers and pickled carrots, and endless bowls of steaming pho. After a month of travel, Una's fury and resentment simmered down some. It only twinged now and again, like a healed broken bone does when it rains. Vietnam was equally enchanting and humbling. The impoverished conditions of many locals put her in her place. Here were people with real hardships, yet she continued to obsess over life's injustices against her. How ungrateful, to mope while staying in 4- and 5-star hotels. How tiresome this sullenness. As she traversed the country, she gave generously to hospitals, orphanages, schools. She prioritized seeing more, giving more, and her mental spotlight shifted away from Edward. She craved crossing more borders, experiencing more unfamiliar environments. And once she'd conquered her boat phobia, a new desire emerged: to escape landlocked areas and spend more time on the water. While she wanted to provide support and companionship to her daughter, after 2 months, Madeline missed the comforts of New York. The novelty of Vietnam had worn off for her, and she was desperate for some good bagels.
"Are you sure you want to continue on by yourself?" Madeline asked. "It can be dangerous, a woman traveling alone, especially abroad."
If it was so dangerous, I probably would have said so in a letter instead of leaving this for myself. She held up her hand with the carved platinum band. Or I would have written something different, like, "Stay home." Una continued alone to Laos and Cambodia, then to Thailand, which she found most enchanting of all. As her wanderlust and appetite for novelty grew, she became less afraid of solitude, of everything. Even Bangkok, with its overwhelming swarm of concrete, color, chaos, its oscillation between holiness and depravity, didn't intimidate her. Granted, she began with the safer tourist attractions. The floating markets, the teak birdcage of the Jim Thompson house, the countless, multi-spired, majestic temples with Buddhas. This one made of jade, that one gold-seated, the other one reclining. She couldn't get enough of the smells. One street infused with jasmine, the next exhaust, the one after that fried pork. And there was the food. Plentiful, inexpensive, and delectable. She ate and ate and ate street food. Skewers of meat, bowls of noodles, crunchy papaya salad. Her taste buds soaking in the key flavors of the native cuisine. Sweet, salty, sour, and spicy. After a couple of weeks in Bangkok, she went island hopping, beginning in Phuket. During the day, Una baked in the sun until her limbs practically sizzled, then cooled off in the turquoise water. Sometimes she'd lie on the beach with her eyes closed and pretend Dale was beside her. Other times she'd join a group of backpackers for games of volleyball or evening gatherings around a bonfire, playing guitar as they sang off-key renditions of Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and Smashing Pumpkins songs. Though when Zero got Blank Stares, she realized it hadn't been released yet, so she stuck to the band's earlier hits. The grunge movement was making its mark around the world, and its unkempt thrift store aesthetic both suited and was popular with many young travelers. They favored torn jeans and baggy band t-shirts, layering on a flannel shirt when the evening temperatures dipped. They also stayed abreast of current events and had heated conversations about the O.J. Simpson trial, the bombing in Oklahoma City, the horrors in Rwanda, Bosnia, and Croatia. The talk of bloodshed was at odds with their paradisiacal environment, but Una admired their commitment to stay informed when they could easily remain in a bubble of pretty beaches, as she was prone to do. At the end of each day, Una washed the sand and salt off her body and imagined shedding a layer of skin. The sun darkened her limbs and lightened her hair, which made her chameleon eyes glimmer like etched glass, her teeth pearly and blinding. Her face grew thinner, her chin and cheekbones sharper as the heat and tranquility of her surroundings absorbed her appetite. When she became restless on one island, she'd head to Koh Phangan for a full moon party, dance all night and sleep on the beach. Or she'd move on to a different island, where she found new splendors even as the sand and surf provided a constant rhythm to her days. She'd felt like a castaway for so long. Why not play at the real thing? How foolish that she'd let her broken chronology confine her for so long. Even the trip to Egypt had been born of avoidance, running away from fate as she was catapulted toward it. But this year abroad wasn't about trying to hide or subvert. It was her rage giving her a choice to fry or fly, say no or say yes. So she chose yes. She said yes at a snake farm when offered a cobra's head to kiss for good luck. She said yes to playing guitar at a party of German divorcees at a beachfront cafe. And yes again, all four times they asked her to play Sheryl Crow's All I Wanna Do. She said yes at a shooting range, firing off rifle rounds at paper targets. She said yes to piercing her navel and yes again to removing the hoop a month later when the piercing became infected. If her future wasn't malleable, why put limits on the present? So she said yes, yes, yes. And sometimes she wished she hadn't, but mostly she was glad she did. No wonder Kenzie had stayed away a full year. Though how did he afford it? Working odd jobs? Family money? It felt good to get lost and was tempting to stay lost. When December came, she thought, where to next? India? China? If culture shock was now her favorite drug, either one should provide an ample fix. But as she considered new destinations, the months apart from her mother became magnified. It was time to return to the familiar. It was time to go home. Una had called Madeline regularly during the year, and though she hadn't felt homesick while exploring villages and jungles and cities and beaches, the moment she arrived at the airport for the journey back, she missed her mother with such ferocity, she could barely endure the day's worth of travel before reaching JFK. Madeline greeted her at the airport with a big bouquet of orchids, which was semi-crushed in their ensuing hug. How was it? Her mother asked. I didn't want it to end, but I'm also glad it did. Sounds like you had a lot of fun. Yeah. Even though bad things also happened. I got pickpocketed and sunburned, and my belly button turned into a horror show, and I never want to hear that Sheryl Crow song again. Still, it was one of the best years of my life.
Pretty remarkable, considering how it started off.
Edward. A part of her still wanted to say his name aloud, the cinders within her still smoldering. But there was a freedom in making mistakes, feeling broken, falling into the void, and then climbing out. A freedom in letting go, setting aside, moving on. She gave her mother a tired, exasperated smile. Don't worry. I won't ask you to mess with my future again. Doesn't seem like I can outrun it anyway. And maybe that's okay. They ended the year drinking champagne in the Park Slope brownstone, Una no longer feeling bereft or betrayed. She missed nobody and regretted nothing. If she could explore foreign countries with ease, she could handle yet another foreign timeline. She was ready for anything. But there are some things nobody is ready for. Part 7. More Than This. 1999. 35. 24. Chapter 24.
Happy New Year and happy birthday!
Una's eyes fluttered open as if from a refreshing nap. No shock, no queasiness, no physical jolt. She was getting used to leaping. Normally, she'd be flooded with a yearning for a return to the sequential, for a remission from this time illness. But she didn't wish for any specific year. Whatever comes next, I can handle it. Happy New Year, Mom. How steady her voice, how relaxed her shoulders, her hands folded in her lap. How wonderful to begin the year serenely instead of disoriented, to float instead of freefall.
It's 1999, and you just turned 35, said her mother from the other end of the couch.
Great. I can't wait to see what the year brings. Madeline tilted her head, eyes bright with intrigue.
There's something different about you.
There is. She offered a secret smile and glanced down. The light caught her platinum ring, the wings winking at her as she turned her hand. What was this? There was writing on her left palm.
I never know what to expect when you leap.
As her mother continued to speak, Una surreptitiously read the note on her hand. Ask Mom about tattoo/check her bag for answers.
And even though it's still the same you each time, I swear, it's almost like your face changes somehow and...
Can you tell me about my tattoo? I think I'm ready for an explanation now. She tried to bury the note of strain in her tranquil tone. Madeline, reaching for her champagne glass on the coffee table, froze in the awkward position, retracted her arm and sat back against the sofa.
Oh, sweetheart. You can't force these things. The right time will present itself, and you'll know what you need to know when you need to know it.
She stood and put her hands on her hips.
Shall we have some cake with this champagne?
Actually, I'd love some tea. Better to choose a beverage meant for warmth and comfort. Plus, it would keep her mom busy for a few extra minutes.
Of course, I'll make you a cup.
Madeline pointed across the room.
In the meantime, your letter's on the mantle.
Okay, thanks. The letter could wait. Once Madeline was out of the room, Una went over to the armchair to her mother's handbag. She sifted through its contents. Leather gloves, a day planner, a tube of hand lotion, receipts, two slim books, Saint-Exupéry's The Little Prince and Rilke's Duino Elegies, a keychain shaped like a miniature dreamcatcher, a pack of tissues. Would any of this help her figure out her tattoo? But then, a flash of yellow in a side pocket caught her eye. A greeting card envelope. A birthday card? It couldn't be for Una. She loathed yellow. She slipped out the buttery envelope. four capital letters were handwritten on it in black ink. M-D-C-R. Her gaze ping-ponged from the envelope to her tattoo, from her mother's cursive to the permanent calligraphy on her wrist.
I hope chamomile is okay.
Madeline came in with a steaming mug.
I put in extra... Oh, shit.
Hastily setting down the mug, she plucked the envelope out of Una's fingers. Her daughter stared at the space the yellow rectangle had occupied, hand still raised.
Sorry I went through your things, but...
What's in the envelope?
I shouldn't have. I should've.
What's in the envelope, Mom? In her head, a trickle of snowfall obscured logical thoughts, the cold white intensifying.
A congratulations card.
Madeline slipped it back into her purse.
For who? For what?
For Mackenzie. For winning an essay contest.
Mackenzie who?
Dread darkened her mother's eyes and she spoke slowly, like she was inching along a narrow ledge. Mackenzie Dale, Charles Ray. Her mental blizzard intensified, each gust of white blowing away half-formed questions.
Let's sit.
A guiding hand on Una's arm, and she went from sitting to standing, from holding nothing to holding a mug of tea. It was her only tattoo. She'd connected the hourglass and swirls of galaxies to Dale, but the initials had eluded her. Like an inept crossword solver, she'd always filled in the blanks incorrectly. Now Una had the answer key. Mackenzie, Dale, Charles, Ray. Yes. Beside her, Madeline sat with her bag on her lap, tentative fingers hovering in the space between them.
Mackenzie, as in Kenzie?
Same person. Perplexed, Una asked.
Why would you not tell me he's my brother?
Because he's not your brother. There was a tremor in Madeline's voice and a crease of dismay between her eyebrows.
Then who is he?
Your son, said Madeline. Two syllables that spun the room sideways. If Una's life had been a string of pearls, this would be when the thread snapped and they scattered. The mug in her hand shook.
There's no way I had a son. I've always been on birth control.
The mug hit the coffee table with a clack as she set it down. Tea sloshed over the sides.
I don't understand. How could... Forget about the tea!
She shooed away her mother's hand, wiping at the spill.
I just don't want it to stain the wood. You might want to reprioritize your list of things to worry about right now.
Una massaged her jaw in a vain attempt to loosen it. Everything felt too tight. Her clothes, her skin, her skull a room with shrinking walls.
I don't even know where to start. I can't believe you've kept this from me. How could you betray me like that?
I never betrayed you, Una. You were the one who decided to keep it a secret. Until he was older. Until you were ready. There was no way you could have raised a child with your... situation.
I know!
Baffled anger clanged through Una like a tower bell.
Hence the fucking birth control!
The clanging quieted, replaced by a murmured mantra of four letters. M-D-C-R. The D stood for... Dale. He was the father? Madeline nodded like a bank teller in a holdup.
Did I?
But there was no need to frame it as a question.
I got pregnant on purpose. Because I knew Dale would die. And since the band wouldn't be his legacy, this would be a way.
Part of him could live on.
Madeline's voice was full of tiptoes. And once you knew your son as a grown man,
It was inevitable you'd want to bring him into the world when you leaped back into your younger self.
I have a son. Dale's son. Kenzie was there in 2015 for my first leap. A hint of relief. Eyes brighter, Madeline said.
He was? Oh, good. You intended for him to be part of your life after he was 18.
No, you don't get to look happy about this.
Her mother's face fell.
I thought he was my assistant. He never said anything about being my son. At most, a friend. Why didn't either of you tell me the truth?
I can't speak for something that hasn't happened yet.
And what about when I met him in 2003? Why did he pretend not to know me? Was he even pretending?
Honey, none of this has happened yet, so I really don't know.
She massaged her temples with her fingertips. Unable to fully process the twisted timelines, she pressed on.
And where is he now?
A friend of mine adopted him. She even agreed to keep the name you gave him, provided he took her surname.
How generous of her! What friend?
Nobody you'd remember.
She moved out of New York when you were little.
She's a lesbian, right?
Madeline dropped her hands.
That's right. How do you know that?
Kenzie told me he had two moms, who'd both die in a few years. But Una wouldn't make the same mistake again. She'd spare her mother this knowledge before it happened.
They're taking great care of him.
Great care?
Una echoed with sarcasm.
Who are these women?
Dark clouds in her head.
Where do they live? Where is my son right now?
I can't tell you.
Are you fucking serious?
Madeline recoiled and put a hand to her cheek.
We have an arrangement with them. I'm allowed to visit once a year under the guise of being a family friend. But he can't know about you until he's 18. I can assure you he's doing well. He's healthy, happy, thriving.
Thriving without me, his birth mother. Unaware his current mothers will be killed before he finishes college.
He's how old now?
Her head too muddled to line up the numbers.
14. 15 in May. Born after Dale died.
She gave her daughter a beseeching look.
You couldn't handle the leaping and being a mother. Plus the grief over Dale.
What about the grief over intentionally having a kid only to give him away?
It wasn't easy. You learned one of the hardest lessons about being a mother early on. You have to put your child first. Your own happiness is less important.
It was a compliment like a piece of candy dusted with arsenic. Una shook her head to refuse it.
Why couldn't you take him? Be more than a distant family friend to him.
Oh, sweetie.
A quiver in her voice.
It's not like I could have hidden him away from you. And there was no way of knowing what kind of impact your leaping would have on him. How could he grow up facing a different version of his mother every year? You wanted to protect him.
And now I want to see him. Is he in New York?
No. I'm sorry, but you can't have any contact with him. The terms of the agreement.
You think I give a shit about any agreement right now? Show it to me. I'll tear it right up. I'll pay whatever fine.
It's more than a fine. You could go to jail. That wouldn't be good for you or your son.
What would you know about it? You let me give away my own child and then lied about it for years. Stellar parenting there, Mom.
Stop it, she snapped. You knew. You knew Kenzie would grow up to be a fine man because you'd seen the result. And when you gave birth, however many leaps later, you knew he'd turn out well-raised by others, hard as that was to accept.
Una paused to consider the twisted logic of tangled timelines, her life like an M.C. Escher drawing, years like staircases turning in on themselves to form a tangible but implausible whole. She wanted to crumple that drawing and toss it aside, get a blank sheet and create her own staircases instead of blindly ascending and descending steps already sketched out for her.
You know what?
She held her mother's gaze, eyes and voice a flat sheet of ice. I'm tired of accepting what earlier Una laid out for me. I've done it before and it fucking backfired. I'm sick of being treated like present-day Una doesn't know what's best for her. And what's best for me right now is to see Kenzie. Now, are you gonna tell me where he is?
I'm sorry, but I can't.
Then I'm sorry, but you need to get out of my house. Madeline opened her mouth in slow motion, but no words came. No sound at all as she stood, collected her things, and left. The tea was tepid, but Una gulped it anyway. It quelled the dryness in her throat, but not the ache. All this time spent missing Dale, while part of him lived on in secret, while her mother knew and said nothing. Yes, Madeline was an easy target for her ire and betrayal. A betrayal that eclipsed Edward's, because this was a matter of blood. But she also had earlier Una to blame. How could she have abandoned Kenzie? It was confounding, this self-loathing for something she'd already done and had yet to do. Like being a warped version of Schrödinger's cat. Not warning herself of a doomed marriage was one thing, but hiding her own child from herself? Earlier Una might have considered that to be sensible and wise, but this Una wanted to tell her to fuck off, to beat the shit out of her, to punch and kick her to a bloody pulp. Empty mug in hand, Una reached back to throw it, aiming at the mantle. Except, there it was. The white envelope with her name on it. Her arm sagged.
Fuck you. Me, she muttered.
Might as well see what her so-called sage self had to say. Una, anger is a poison and forgiveness is the antidote.
What kind of fortune cookie bullshit is that?
She seethed. Of course, that's not going to help you right now. Your anger is totally justified. There's nothing I can tell you that'll make you understand certain choices I made. I keep thinking if I share some of the things I've learned, you won't have to learn them the hard way. Instead, trying to protect you often ends up making things more convoluted. So I'll keep it simple. In your top desk drawer is a plane ticket and a post-it with an address. Kenzie is in Boston. More information awaits when you get there. Chapter 25. All Una brought to Boston was a backpack, a small suitcase, and her guitar. The taxi dropped her off on a narrow cobblestone street in Beacon Hill, lined with brick row homes. Snow dusted their black window shutters and old-fashioned gas lamps dotted the block. Picture postcard perfect. Is this where my son lives? She matched the number on the door to the address on the post-it. As she was about to ring the bell, she stopped, her finger an inch away from it. What if Kenzie's life was as lovely and perfect as these homes? Could she really come stomping in amidst all this quiet charm? Could she cause such a disruption? Then again, how could she not see her child? A child she had with her first, arguably only, love. However idyllic his home, however much he might be thriving under the upbringing of his adopted mothers, it was no substitute for his biological mom. I'm doing a good thing here. It shouldn't have required so much self-coaxing, but she rang the bell, waited agonizing seconds before the door opened. A rotund, rosy-cheeked woman with wispy white hair and Ben Franklin-style eyeglasses stood before her. Is this one of the women raising my son? She's old enough to be his grandmother. Older than his actual grandmother. Una opened her mouth to deliver the impassioned speech she'd silently practiced on the journey to Boston. All that came out was a cloud of foggy breath.
Una, how lovely to see you. Happy New Year.
The woman drew a shawl around herself against the cold, her face friendly, absent of suspicion.
Happy New Year,
Una echoed, though the phrase rang hollow. Shocking New Year, more like. Bitter New Year.
Come in, come in. It's nippy out there.
She beckoned, opening the door wider.
I've got your keys and paperwork close by.
Taking cautious steps, Una set her bags and guitar case inside the threshold. Keys to what?
How frightful having your purse stolen. That's why I never ride the subway when I visit New York. I'm glad you weren't hurt.
She sorted through a wicker basket on a side table in the foyer.
I changed the locks as soon as I got your message. Now I know I put these keys in here. Where are the darn things?
Jingling and rustling as she sifted through odds and ends. I have an apartment in Boston. Una tried to remain quiet so she could gradually piece together what was going on. But tempering her impatience was tricky.
Do you?
Una crafted the question as innocuously as possible.
Do you know my mother, Madeline Lockhart?
It was unlikely, but she had to know if this woman was raising Kenzie.
I'm afraid I don't.
Her eyebrows scrunched together.
Do I look like someone she knows? I get that a lot. I must have one of those faces.
That must be it. Una scraped her lower lip with her teeth.
Ah, I remember what I did with them. I put them with the copy of your lease in this drawer. Here we are.
She held out a folded sheet of paper and two shiny keys.
Now you must promise you'll be more careful.
I will, thank you. How much do I owe you for the locksmith?
You paid a year's rent up front. Double what I would have charged for the place, so I won't accept an extra cent from you.
A dismissive wave and firm shake of her head. The address on the lease took Una to a ground floor apartment several doors down, a spacious one bedroom decorated in black, white, and red, minimalist and modern. Many would have found the living space sterile, but Una took comfort in its darkness. Taped to the bathroom mirror was another letter. Una, the situation with Kenzie is delicate. You must respect that he's being raised by caring, responsible women. Shivani and Faye, who are terrific parents. You must also be aware of a legal agreement in place with them. It includes terms akin to a restraining order. You're not allowed to contact Kenzie before he turns 18. But now that you know he's your son, I'm sure nothing will stop you from seeing him. So I've come up with a way for you to do so. After school on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays,